The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mary Grace Payden for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Religion in the News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Religion News Service, Global Christian Relief, and the Los Angeles Times. First of all, an article published by the Religion News Service on the 30th of January, written by Alejandra Molina, and entitled, U.S. Hispanic Protestant Churches Are Young, Growing, and Largely New to the Country. Hispanic Protestant churches are growing in the United States, and many of these congregations are relatively new, identify as evangelical, and largely include people who are new to the country, according to a recently released survey. The study, conducted by Evangelical Research from Lifeway, found that less than 9% of Hispanic congregations trace their history prior to 1950, with most, 54%, having been established since 2000, including 32% founded since 2010 or later. Half of the churches, 50%, are in a large metropolitan area with a population of 100,000 or more, and in the average Hispanic Protestant church, 35% of the congregation is under the age of 30, the survey found. The people from the surveyed congregations are also fairly new to the U.S., with the majority, 58%, reported to be first-generation Americans who were born outside of the country. As a result, a majority, 53%, conduct their services only in Spanish, while 22% are bilingual. We see more and more English-speaking churches either planting a Hispanic church or adding a service in Spanish to their current congregation, said Giancarlo Montemayor, director of global publishing for the research firm's Hispanic division, Lifeway Recursos. The study, which surveyed 692 pastors of Hispanic congregations, was sponsored by Lifeway Recursos, the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association, and Samaritan's Purse. Only congregations that were at least 50% Hispanic were included. The survey was conducted in 2022 from September the 6th to November the 1st. Surveyed pastors were from American Baptist Churches USA, Assemblies of God, United Church of Christ, Seventh-day Adventist, Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, Concilio Evangelico International, Southern Baptist Convention, United Methodist Church, and other groups, including non-denominational churches. Most of the pastors, 79%, self-identified as evangelical, with 16% who said they were mainline. Jonathan Cavillo, an assistant professor of Latinx studies at Emory's Candler School of Theology, was intrigued to see that most Latino Protestant churches were not connected to an English-speaking or white church. While some of the congregations were started by white churches, the survey found that only 14% of the Hispanic congregations in this study conducted services within a church that was predominantly non-Hispanic, said Scott McConnell, executive director of Lifeway Research. That's an interesting insight because I've come across an assumption that Latino Protestants are directly tied to white churches and white leaders, said Cavillo, whose research has focused on how religious affiliation influences ethnic identities among Latinos. This shows otherwise. To Montemayor, a former pastor in Austin, Texas, the study's findings highlight the importance of Latinos having something in their own language with their own culture. It goes beyond translated content, Montemayor said, and that includes resources in their own preaching style and music. They want their own roots in the congregation, Montemayor said. The survey also found that COVID-19 was still impacting many of these congregations. Fear of the pandemic, along with long work hours, extended family gatherings, and personal hardship, were the primary hindrances Hispanic Protestant churchgoers cited as keeping them from participating more regularly, according to the study. Within U.S. Hispanic Protestant churches, the survey found that the average worship attendance was 115. Prior to the pandemic, in January 2020, average attendance was 136. Interestingly enough, those at churches with average attendance of 0 to 49, 28%, and 50 to 99, 28%, were more likely to say fear of the pandemic affected their church participation than those at churches with attendance of 100 to 249 at 16%, according to the report. Next, an article from the Religion News Service that was published on the 26th of January and written by Heather Green. Rosary beads? Yes, but crystals? No. Catholic school counselor loses her job. For two marketing classes taught at North Catholic High School in the Diocese of Pittsburgh, a career and college counselor at the school invited three owners of a local store to talk about how they run a small business. As part of their visit in December, the store owners offered each student a small crystal. That's because the business, Elemental Magic, sells books, jewelry, candles, and other items used in various metaphysical practices. The three store owners, married couple Tabitha and Tamara Latshaw, and their sister-in-law, Carrie Latshaw, are all Wiccan high priestesses. "We sell crystal," said Tabitha Latshaw in a video statement posted to Facebook. "If we sold gum, we would have handed out a pack of gum." But after some students complained to North Catholic administrators, according to reports, the counselor, who has not been identified publicly, was questioned and then in early January asked to resign. In an interview with KDKA-TV, Michelle Peduto, a diocesan school administrator, explained that educators at diocesan schools are required to sign a statement saying that their instruction will align with Catholic teachings. Both the visit and the crystals were not a good fit, she said. "It is because, as we know, our faith is in Jesus Christ and not in objects necessarily," Peduto said. "Rosary beads, yes, but crystals, no." North Catholic, founded in 1939 as a boys' school and staffed traditionally by the Marian Order, is an anchor of Catholic life in Pittsburgh. Alumni include former CIA director Michael Hayden and the late owner of the Pittsburgh Steelers, Dan Rooney. Formerly known as the Cardinal Wuerl North Catholic High School, after the former bishop and archbishop of Washington, D.C., the school removed the cardinal's name in 2018 at his request after he was criticized for his handling of sexual abuse cases there. According to the KDKA-TV report, letters were sent home after the store owner's appearance in the marketing classes. The letters asked families to dispose of the crystals and to cleanse their homes by saying a prayer to St. Michael, the archangel. The Diocese of Pittsburgh reportedly labeled the employee's actions inappropriate and in a letter to the former employee, egregious. The Latshaws did not know of their friend's departure from North Catholic until a reporter asked for their reaction. After learning the news, the store owners have used the situation to demonstrate the popularity of crystals across various religions and in society at large. A recent survey by Springtide Research Institute shows that 44% of Gen Z use crystals and herbs for spiritual connection or entertainment. Crystals are everywhere and are exclusive to no religion, including Wicca, said Tabitha Latshaw, pointing out that in the jewelry industry, crystals are more commonly known as semi-precious gemstones. The store owners label their weekly Sunday crystal sale, "God created this." "You don't have to be a witch to use crystals," Latshaw said. "We have people of all walks of faith come in here." The Latshaws say they weren't there to talk about witchcraft or religion of any kind. "We went to North Catholic High School to discuss becoming entrepreneurs," Tabitha Latshaw told Religion News Service. She told KDKA-TV, "God made these. They come from the earth. That's all I can say." The former school employee told the local reporter that she did not believe that the crystals or the owner's religion would cause a stir. In hindsight, she recognized she should have thought the visit through more carefully, but she was surprised that the situation was not used as an opportunity for me to grow and develop as a professional and as a Catholic. Now a piece from the Global Christian Relief Organization, published on January the 27th and written by David Curry, who is the president and CEO of Global Christian Relief, entitled, "It's Time to Wake Up to the Realities of Global Persecution." Christian persecution has reached historically high levels and is exponentially growing around the world. Research shows that 350 million Christians live in a nation where they are regularly attacked, discriminated against, falsely imprisoned, shunned from their communities, and sometimes even killed for their faith. The situation has grown increasingly complex thanks to the emergence of new technologies and government entities becoming more digitally focused. Bad actors now exploit electronic methods to harass Christians and religious minorities by freezing assets, banning social media communications, and deplatforming them. Additionally, shifting geopolitical alliances and the rise of new authoritarian regimes have created potential difficulties for intervention. China has already created the world's most advanced anti-Christian surveillance state, using leading-edge technology, such as facial recognition software, to track the whereabouts and religious practices of Christians. China's president, Xi Jinping, labels Christians in the nation as unpatriotic, and Beijing has sent out strong messages to youth, teachers, and parents that religion will harm their education. In countries like North Korea, Christian persecution is expected to worsen this year. Kim Jong-un regime's views Christianity as a tool used by the United States and Western powers to colonize other countries, and routinely utilizes propaganda to educate its citizens about the dangers of the Bible. Human rights organizations recently concluded that crimes against humanity continue on a massive scale, and Christians in particular are targeted and tortured. Those who are fortunate enough to escape North Korea find no refuge in China, as the Chinese government has indicated a willingness to deport defectors. India has also become a hotbed of Christian persecution, where documented attacks surged by 81% between 2020 and 2021. At least 10 Indian states now have anti-conversion laws on the books, which is a legal way to force people into the religion of the state, criminalize religious conversions, and threaten offenders with jail time and heavy fines. During this past Christmas season, more than 1,000 Christians were subjected to violence, with many converted to Hinduism. These examples are only the tip of the persecution iceberg. In Nigeria, Fulani extremists killed thousands of Christians and destroyed at least 17 villages in the year 2022. Christians who have remained in Afghanistan more than a year after the Taliban takeover are forbidden to openly worship or evangelize, and converts from Islam are often killed by members of their own families. In Pakistan, human rights experts continue to document the kidnapping and trafficking of teenage girls, many of them Christian, who are forced to marry and convert to Islam. And yet the Western Church is largely unaware of the plight of our brothers and sisters around the world who are regularly suffering. For many American Christians, it's easy to think of persecution as something that happens over there, thousands of miles away, across oceans, on different continents. But in both Romans and 1 Corinthians, the Bible makes clear we are all one body in Christ, no matter where we live. What one part of the body suffers, we all suffer. In this moment, we cannot avoid this question. What kind of organization is needed to most effectively support persecuted Christians? By creating the world's most extensive covert network serving Christians who suffer for their faith, Global Christian Relief, the organization I lead, hopes to more effectively support persecuted believers in the moment. We are broadening our vision to include a greater focus on technology, a streamlined mechanism for mobilizing the American church to advocate, and expanded partnerships with people on the front lines who are living and working in some of the most difficult countries to follow Jesus. There are a handful of groups devoted to this cause, and each is doing vital and necessary work that benefits countless believers across the globe. But the need is so great that there could be 1,000 organizations. I pray American congregations will be quickly awakened to this global reality and roused into action. The need for people of faith with expertise in technology, social media, banking, tax law, and so many other sectors will be crucial to helping our brothers and sisters weather these worsening attacks. Because now is not the time to be asleep. Now, an article from the Religion News Service that was published on January 27th and written by Bob Smetana. His art was an act of sacred listening, says Portrait in Faith photographer. A chance encounter with a church janitor helped change the course of Daniel Epstein's life. Epstein, then a marketing director for Procter & Gamble, was in Maine for a photography workshop and went out to take portraits of people in the community. He decided to stop by local churches to see if he could photograph the ministers. But there was no minister at the first church he stopped at, only the janitor. I kept saying to him, "I'm looking for the minister," he said. Finally, I realized God put the janitor in front of me. That portrait of a church janitor in Maine was the first of more than 500 Epstein has collected over the past 20 years. What was first a hobby became a passion project and a spiritual journey of holy listening for Epstein, one that took him from Rockport, Maine to Madurai, Julie, Australia. A selection of his portraits is now on display as part of an exhibit called Seeing the Other at the University of Chicago Laboratory Schools. The exhibit opened in January and runs through March the 7th. Many of his portraits are also posted online at Epstein's Portraits in Faith website and in a coffee table book published in 2021. Epstein, who grew up Jewish in Atlanta, said in an interview that he'd always had an interest in interfaith work, and that played a role in his project. His subjects ranged from Catholic priest and author Richard Rohr and Reiki healer Allison Ledbetter in Nashville to Sheikh Abdulaziz Bukhara in Jerusalem and the late Aboriginal leader and songwriter Uncle Bob Randall in Australia. Randall, who died in 2015, told Epstein about being taken away from his family as a child and being placed in an institution for Aboriginal children run by Methodists. It was there, Randall told Epstein, that he encountered the teachings of Jesus in a red-letter Bible. You could go straight into those words. They made more sense to me than what the missionaries were talking about, said Randall. Randall would eventually see some similarities between those words of Jesus and Aboriginal beliefs, though he saw a few Christians living them out. He also told Epstein about seeing all creation as holy. Sheikh Abdul Aziz Bukhari told Epstein about traveling to the U.S. as a young man and living a life that was far from faith. That changed, he said, after a near-death experience that followed a heart attack. Many of the portraits were taken when Epstein traveled the world in his role at Procter & Gamble. He'd add personal days onto the end of trips and find subjects with the help of friends and other contacts. Along with taking portraits, Epstein would interview his subjects about their spiritual journey, focusing more on the experience of faith rather than on doctrine or the specifics of theology. The conversations were guided with questions like, "Tell me about your earliest memory of faith. What was the first time in your life you felt like you had to or chose to rely upon God? And what are you most grateful for?" Epstein, who has always loved taking photographs and talking with people, said the project fit his interest. "It's really been a combination of all the things I love in my life," he said. "It's a much more interesting way to travel around the world than to go around the marketplace taking pictures of spices." When he started working on portraits in faith, Epstein described himself as miserable. He said he was too self-absorbed and involved in unhealthy relationships. There was not much gratitude in his life. "I once had a psychiatrist in Boston describe me as a young man who was not happy about much," he said. Listening to other people's journeys of faith helped to change that. Many of the people he met were grateful for their lives, something that was foreign to him. That gratitude began to rub off on him, he said. The more time he spent listening to other people's stories, the more healing he experienced. "I like to say that the guy working on this project was the best version of me," he said. Gina Alessia, director of Corvus Gallery, which is hosting the exhibit, and an art teacher at the laboratory school, said Epstein's portraits and his ideas about listening to other people's journeys drew her to his work. "That work," she said, "is especially meaningful at a divisive time in America's history. I thought that this would be a poignant moment to bring this to the University of Chicago and share with our students and have them ponder that question of how can we as a community listen to each other and bring a deeper understanding of each other." Early on in the project, Epstein, who now lives in Cincinnati, said he thought the point of the project was to give people a chance to tell their stories. Now, he said, he's come to see the project as an act of sacred listening, where he can give his full attention to another person's story. "It became what I call my sacred errand, which I'm so grateful that I've been sent on," he said. "I don't even feel like the project belongs to me. I feel like I've just been assigned to it." And finally, an excerpt from an article published in the Los Angeles Times on the 1st of February, written by Deborah Netburn. National Catholic Reporter's new publisher embraces role. In his first column as publisher of the National Catholic Reporter, former television executive and journalist Joe Ferrullo declared that the Roman Catholic Church is at a crossroads, pull between two radically different versions of the future. Writing in early December, Ferrullo explained that a series of synods, or listening sessions, held in parishes around the world under the direction of Pope Francis, have revealed a hunger among the faithful for a church that was more welcoming to its LGBTQ members and that allowed more opportunity for women to take on leadership roles. And yet, in November, the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops had elected conservatives to nearly every important leadership role, including the group's new president, Archbishop Timothy Broglio, who has served as Archbishop for the Military Services since 2008. Experts who follow the church saw the election results as a pointed repudiation by the U.S. bishops of Pope Francis's more inclusive version. What path does the church take in the generations ahead? Does it expand the tent and reach out, or does it circle the wagons and close in, Ferullo wrote. It's impossible to know where that path will lead by the end of 2024, but these next 2 years could easily turn out to be the most decisive since Vatican II. As publisher of the 59-year-old National Catholic Reporter, where liberal voices have long held sway, Ferullo will have a front seat to the unfolding historic drama that could affect the church for years to come. And perhaps that explains why a guy 3 years into a comfortable retirement might decide to take on the anxiety and the thrill of running this scrappy and beloved Catholic news organization. I thought about teaching, he said, but there's not as much fun in that. He also believes that the future of the Catholic Church should be of interest not just to Catholics, but to anyone who follows politics in America. Despite the fact that the church is shrinking in numbers in this country, it still has a lot of influence, he said. If you're angry at Dobbs, then you're angry at the group of Catholics who helped push that, including all those conservative Catholic Supreme Court justices, he said, referring to the court case that overturned the constitutional right to an abortion. Ferullo, 65, is warm and wiry with dark graying hair. During an interview at a Le Pain Quotidien, a short drive from his studio city home, he described himself as a lifelong practicing Catholic. He grew up in the late 1960s in a working-class neighborhood in the Bronx, New York, where his family belonged to a parish that fully embraced the reforms of Vatican II. Latin masses were replaced with folk masses. The nuns at his parochial school removed their traditional habits, and his sixth grade teacher and math teacher, Sister Marianne, occasionally taught the class Simon and Garfunkel songs instead of long division. It was a very cool time, especially as a kid, he said, and it's what's kept me Catholic, even as things become more secular around me. We've run out of time for today's episode of Religion in the News. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mary Grace Payden, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Religion in the News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please call us at 919-832-5138. Again, that's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.